title of this lecture did deliberately, because Joseph Schumpeter, whose Capitalism, Socialism and Democracy, first published in 1942, contains some dense chapters, almost a book within the book, devoted to the uncertain future of capitalism. To the question, can capitalism survive, he famously responded in the negative, making a reasoned argument about trustification as a stabilizing force of the capitalist process, ultimately leading to the extinction of entrepreneurial drive and what we might call bureaucratic socialism. Schumpeter was writing in the wake of the Great Depression and the New Deal. Until then, he had maintained a rather optimistic outlook of the future, to the point that one is understandably dismayed by the little sensibility that his overall view of development displays for the social consequences of creative destruction. Recurrent fluctuations and crises were seen by Schumpeter the theorist as the price to pay for enjoying a constant rise of living standards in the long run. Schumpeter the prophet remains unconcerned with these issues. To him, socialism means essentially a different way of organizing production. Indeed, its possible advent has to do with the eclipse of the bourgeoisie, or, to put it better, of the Belle Époque upper class, after the upheavals of two world wars. But is not really interested in understanding how this would affect society. In 1942, Paul Sweezy published his rival theory, a translation of Marx into the language of modern economics. His critique of Schumpeter rests on the objection that accumulation precedes innovation, and not vice versa. Accumulation is seen as a historical process. Sweezy's theory of capitalist development may well be wrong, but one cannot say it is ahistorical. Schumpeter's book, on the other hand, offers an example of a historical prophecy. It confuses capitalism with its competitive form. And much of the later debate on varieties of capitalism would not make much sense if it was strictly based on Schumpeter's concept of capitalism. Schumpeter drew to some extent on Weber's interpretation of modern bureaucracy. The decline of entrepreneurship and the trend towards industrial concentration go hand in hand with the transformation of charismatic authority into bureaucratic routine. Weber's theory, however, has deeper roots and a more flexible character. The process of bureaucratization doesn't necessarily lead to the end of capitalism. After saying that the Geist has escaped from the cage and has become superfluous since capitalism now rests on mechanical foundations, he makes a rather open-minded statement. Quote, no one knows who will live in this cage in the future, or whether at the end of this tremendous development entirely new prophets will arise, or there will be a great rebirth of old ideas and ideals, or if neither, mechanized petrification embellished with a sort of convulsive self-importance. End of quote. Weber's metaphor is beautiful, and I will soon return to it as it might help to help define our problem. However, the concept of iron cage requires some qualifications. If we are to give a faithful reading of Weber, we must link it to his definition of formal rationality of economic action. This idea was later developed in a communist society, and it's not without ambiguity. From a theoretical point of view, it presupposes that economic behavior can be separated from the social value structure. The great constructions of Pareto and Parsons, who regard the economic as an autonomous sphere of social action, start from here. I'm not sure that this is a realistic assumption, and therefore, in a previous work, I used the expression Weber's deadlock. From a historical point of view, Weber's thesis implies that capitalist development has been sustained by two different motives. In an earlier phase, it was propelled by value-oriented rationality, whereby the values were those of religious asceticism, and in a later phase, this substantive rationality has turned into formal or purposive rationality. Capitalism has broken away almost completely from its originary spirit and has become a self-sustained process. I personally believe that capitalism might become, and it has actually become, a self-sustained process without rejecting the value structure from which it originated. This underlying structure can sometimes be hidden or latent, but is always ready to resurface. Human culture is something that evolves only very slowly, and Durkheim told us the reason. Sudden changes would result in anomie, and that's a price that society cannot afford to pay. When I speak of culture, I mean it in the anthropological sense. And whenever I come across a postmodernist or even a British social anthropology who deny its existence, I feel sad for them. I'm on the side of Clifford Geertz and those who think that our job is one of interpretation. We discussed it this last time. A job of esteem, aimed at reconstructing the meaning that humans attach to their own actions. There are other uses of the term culture, indeed. For example, in Antonio Gramsci's theory of cultural hegemony, or in Daniel Bell's 1976 book, The Cultural Contradictions of Capitalism. Frightened by what he saw as the hippie transition from the Protestant ethic to the psychedelic bazaar, Bell complained that capitalism was eroding the value system that had sustained it in a way that reminds of Schumpeter's contempt for anti-bourgeois intellectuals. This performative use of the term, hinting at the arts, aesthetics, and so on, is legitimate, though possibly misleading. These are actually epiphenomena of culture, and it would be preferable, in my view, to disambiguate such concepts, as the Germans do when they refer to Kultur as opposed to Zivilisation. Otherwise, each time the surface of society gets stirred up by a passing breeze, this may come to be mistaken for the ultimate factor that will cause capitalism to collapse. This idea that capitalist development rests on mechanical foundations is not unique to Weber. It is, above all, an idea of Marx. But for Marx, this doesn't only apply to mature capitalism, but to the whole of human history. Thanks to this substantial predictability of the socio-economic articulation, from a few elementary forces, those operating within the base, historical materialism aims to derive the laws of motion of capitalism and the other modes of production that preceded it. Since Marx's time, history has taught us that such forces are neither few nor elementary, and the hope to identify any laws of motion is probably utopia. There is nonetheless something we can learn from the intuitions and also from the mistakes of these giants of social thought. First, embeddedness of economic action in a culture-specific web of significance cannot be seen as a mere superstructure, for the web survives the decomposition of economic structures, and to some extent, even that of social structures. This, however, is not to say that we must take the existence of culture as an act of God. Environmental constraints such as geography and the technical possibilities of production have an impact on what people think and the rules they follow, but the latter form a rather stable framework that tends to perpetuate itself almost by inertia. If you feel inclined to functionalism, then you can call this function latency, otherwise just habitus, a la Bourdieu. Conversely, it's also true that the influence exerted by material forces on the economy itself can be long-lasting. This allows us to analyze economic processes as if they were animated by an inner logic. An obvious example is globalization, the dynamic of scale and scope, the spread of the division of labor across the continents, the dialectic between center and periphery. These mechanisms have been around since the 17th century. All of them are related to the profitability principle that drives investments in the capitalist system. But profit itself is a value. Thus, much of what we call material is actually crystallized culture. And yet, globalization has its counterbalance in phenomena of cultural resistance. Not only the resistance of global activists, the discontents, as Joseph Stiglitz once referred to them, but the reactions of politics and society in the global South and East. Cultures also have the capacity to aspire, as Arjan Appadurai puts it, they nurture ideas of the future as much as of those about the past. This cultural resilience has even taken the form of a more cautious, not to say critical, reception of Western social science and historiography, as in the post-colonial approaches of Said Baba, Chakravarti, and many others. How is the interaction of cultural variables and material forces contributing to the current predicament of European welfare states? The material preconditions for the modern welfare state were created between the 19th and 20th centuries in the framework of mature, that is to say, large-scale industrialization. This is a stage that Germany, as a late joiner, reached quite rapidly in the last quarter of the 19th century. By that time, Britain had already ascended to the industrial zenith and was on the way to relative decline. It's a gray area that doesn't fit well with the usual periodizations. I suppose it can be situated in between Werner Sombart's phases of hoc capitalismus and spec capitalismus. This is when social policy acquired academic dignity and political influence with the Verein. The main issue addressed by the Bismarckian Sozialstaat was the workers' protection. The corporatist nature of the German regime is partly a result of its original association with the context of labor relations. In Britain, the early 20th century liberal reforms prompted by the first Rome III survey and associated with Lloyd George. Let's call them the pre-Beveridgian welfare state, were made in the wake of the German example and essentially directed to the working class, either active workers, their children, or the elderly. The modern welfare state can be alternatively thought of as an achievement of progress and civilization, according to the evolutionary interpretations of T.H. Marshall and Richard Titmuss, as an instrument of decommodification, following Polanyi and Esping Andersen, or, on the contrary, as a precondition itself of the commodification of labor power, as Klaus Hoffe's view of the interdependence between commodifying capitalism and non-commodified support systems suggests. Who is right, then? Let's suspend the judgment for a moment. Contradictions in welfare capitalism started to emerge in the 1970s. As early as 1973, two important works from the Frankfurt School had already appeared. These were Hoffe's Toto Probleme des Kapitalistischen Staates and Habermas' Legitimation Probleme in Spät Kapitalismus. These analyses differed from conventional Marxism in that the explanatory key was no longer seen in economic variables, but rather sought at the social and political level. According to Habermas, late capitalism is characterized by a repoliticization of the relations of production. Resource allocation and wealth distribution are subjected to political negotiation. This involves price fixing instead of price competition and a quasi-political wage structure. Yet society is still based on free enterprise, and capitalist firms keep pursuing their own goals according to the principles of utilitarian rationality. There follows a continual need for legitimization that is addressed by the state in such a way that conflict is kept latent. Permanent inflation is the main strategy resorted to, but it has the potential to set off fiscal crisis, which in turn will affect the provision of welfare services. Habermas was drawing on Hoffe's view of the contradictions of welfare capitalism. These lie in the fact that the welfare state is at the same time an agent of commodification and decommodification. Public policies constrain choices in the production sphere, but are also constrained by them. The private or capitalist subsystem has to be maintained healthy and financially viable in order to be able to make the profits upon which the remuneration of labor depends. John Keane has effectively described this self-limiting nature of such an institution. At any one point in time, he writes, the welfare state seeks to maintain the economic dominance of capital, to challenge and erode its power, and to compensate for its disruptive and disorganizing consequences. In retrospect, one must acknowledge that critical theory had the merit to point out how fragile the foundation of the post-war equilibrium were. But these analyses have limits, also due to the fact that in the 70s the scene was still in the making. In his Gekaufte Zeit, Wolfgang Streeck has made an important point about the role of capital in these depictions. The Franco theorists neglected that capital is an active player and is capable of strategic thinking. In fact, the legitimation crisis so far has been more a consequence of the claims of capital than of those of labor. Capital has driven the transition from the peacekeeper state to the neoliberal state, or from the tax state to the debt and austerity state, as he puts it. For those used to observe the world through 20th century categories, this has represented a paradoxical outcome. I'd like to make two further points. In the Frankfurt theory, the legitimation problem and the eventual fiscal crisis of the state arise from the trade-off between private and public interest. It's still the original dispossession that spirals into a vicious cycle. But social conflict may result from other circumstances. The Krisen theory is almost entirely focused on elements that are endogenous to capitalism as a social system. It doesn't take into account exogenous factors that concur in the physiological slowdown of growth in all major economies, as it happened in the 70s, quite independently of the oil shocks. Indeed, these factors may also affect wage dynamic, as is shown in the dual sector model put forward by development economist Arthur Lewis in the 50s. In a developing economy, you can often observe the coexistence of an agricultural sector which still plays a non-negligible role in the livelihood of households, along with an expanding industrial sector. As capital accumulation proceeds, the bulk of the labor force gradually shifts from the primary to the secondary sector. Accordingly, the industrial labor market for a while can enjoy what Lewis calls an unlimited supply of labor. In the graph, this corresponds to the horizontal or perfectly elastic segment of the labor supply curve. And in this phase, when industrial production expands, and so the labor demand curve shifts forward, you see that wages don't increase. This is the level of wages. But after, let's say, 20 or 30 years, the labor reserves in the primary sector are exhausted, and the wages, as you see, start to increase. In the aftermath of World War II, in many Western countries as well as in Japan, a substantial portion of the total labor force was still employed in agriculture. Agricultural workers made up 30% of the total labor force in France, 24% in Germany, 42% in Italy, and 49% in Japan. By contrast, only 13% of US workers and 5% of British workers in around 1950 were employed in the primary sector. Today, in all these countries, agricultural workers account for less than 5% of the total labor force. In general, no need, there's really no need to run a regression to show this. The higher these figures, the higher the rates of post-war economic growth. This is what made possible the French Trente Glorieuse, the German Wirtschaftswunder, and the economic miracles of Italy and Japan. From the perspective of economic performance, strictly conceived, the Golden Age was far less golden in the US and in the UK because these were already mature economies. In fact, Germany makes a partial exception. It had become an industrial power well before World War II, but it took time to reconstitute the capital and infrastructure lost in the war. The story told by the Lewis model doesn't repeat itself with the transition from an industrial to a service economy, for gains in productivity are much smaller and slower in this new context. People already have food and shelter, and the mass market consumer goods brought about by the second and third waves of industrialization. To a greater extent, than in the past, wealth reproduction in post-affluent societies depends on the machinery for consumer demand creation, of which the culture industry is part. Last but not least, the focus of market competition has shifted to positional goods, as Fred Hirsch could already see in 1976. Those who are now in their 20s struggle to maintain their parents' status and wages as well, while universities compete to offer market-oriented academic or pseudo-academic programs that will leave the students overqualified and underemployed. In this sense, waste rather than productivity seems to be the hallmark of the post-industrial economies. Whatever the best explanation for the end of the Golden Age, it's a matter of fact that Keynesianism works well in a context where there are no structural limits to economic growth, and growth can be fostered by public expenditure. In turn, economic growth ensures social peace as it reduces pressure on the resources and allows the state to offer concessions to both capital and labor. These preconditions, as we know, ceased to exist in the 70s. The second and more important problem with the Frankfurt theory is that it is inconsistent with what we know from the early modern history of welfare. In an effort to make the past fit with the Marxist schema, it is twisted. As Hoffer writes, in the early phase of capitalist society, social policies were provided through traditional forms of organizations, including guilds, families, communities, and churches. However, with the disaggregation and mobilization of poor populations, these traditional organizations are themselves undermined and therefore fail to function to the extent that is functionally required for the development of capitalism. As we saw in our first conversation, the reality is quite different. There is no direct transition from informal welfare institutions in a pre-capitalist system to the formal welfare institutions of the capitalist state. But on the contrary, two or three centuries of non-capitalist state with its own formal welfare institutions. Marx's unreliable account of the transition from feudalism to capitalism has to be contextualized in a time when the study of history was still in its infancy. Zombart proved this account wrong, and the concept of moderne capitalismus was coined out of the need to differentiate modern capitalism as a comprehensive system of social organization from early modern merchant capitalism, an economic activity involving a minority of people in a no longer feudal, but not yet capitalist society. Unsurprisingly, the Frankfurt view also downplays the legacy of the Enlightenment and the extent to which social rights have become part of a shared domain of common expectations. These are possibly to do with the pessimistic view of the Enlightenment's unfulfilled promise from Horkheimer's and Adorno's dialectic thereof Clerc. Habermas' starting point in the theory of communicative action is still the empty shell of Weber's Zweckrationalität, form without content, which leaves little hope for human progress, and rather testifies to the modern and a fortiori postmodern loss of meaning. Yet it's difficult to interpret Beveridge's break from the Bismarckian logic unless the universalist principles underlying the attack on the five giant evils of society are traced back to the modern idea of citizenship. Even more tied to an evolutionary human rights framework is the principle which also made headway in the aftermath of World War II, that all citizens, without distinction of status or class, should be offered the best standards available in relation to a certain agreed range of social services. This, according to Asa Briggs, goes beyond the aims of a social service state. It brings in the idea of the optimum rather than the older idea of the minimum. At this point, you might think the view of critical theory may well be historically inaccurate, but who cares? Who cares about early modern welfare and the legacy of the Enlightenment? Why do they matter today, since welfare states are being seriously undermined? They matter a lot. Is it really plausible to suppose the extinction of the welfare state? If history shows that some form of welfare state, not just informal welfare support, preexisted modern capitalism, then there will be no reason to believe that the present troubles of capitalism will determine its annihilation. Secondly, my hypothesis is that when culture collides with the mechanical foundations of a socio-economic system, some adjustment is required. This can take the form of a peaceful compromise, of a full earthquake, or of a milder tremor followed by a series of aftershocks. In any case, some degree of instability as to be expected. We will discuss such aspects later. In the light of these considerations, I believe that the issues of the future of welfare states and the future of capitalism should be kept conceptually distinct. Not that they don't have any relationships, the links are all too evident, but if we postulate an excessive interdependence between the two, then we will end up constructing mechanistic models. Mechanistic models, just like Marx's equation encapsulating the supposed tendency of the rate of profit to fall, almost never prove to be realistic. In the remaining time, I will try to address separately three points: the survival of capitalism, the economic possibilities of socialism, and how welfare can fit in these scenarios. This is not going to be an exercise in futurology, but rather a fallible attempt, a very fallible attempt, to use our understanding of the past to make sense of the present, bearing in mind that the present is an ever-evolving reality in the Heraclitean sense. So, will ever capitalism come to an end? Sure it will. As all other historical social systems did in the past. It may seem a trivial statement, but there are scholars such as Deepak Lal, Deirdre McCloskey, and in a subtler way, Joyce Appleby, who still subscribe to the end of history thesis, emphasizing the plasticity of capitalism and its capacity to adapt to different political and cultural contexts. I come from reading the text of Professor Streeck's lecture, Has Capitalism Seen Its Day?, which he delivered at the British Academy a couple of weeks ago. Wolfgang's thesis is that capitalism is on its way out because it has won. In the neoliberal age, it has lost the internal dialectic upon which it thrived and survived. With the unprecedented commodification of money, human labor, and nature, the market has expanded beyond the level of financial, relational, and environmental sustainability. Moreover, globalization has neutralized any attempts to check or contain this process. However, the disintegration of capitalism, which he compares to the gradual implosion of the Roman Empire, is going to be painful and take a long time, probably centuries. When a system shows sign of decline, it's entirely understandable to have no idea what will come next. An exemplary awareness of the limits of sociological imagination is something we find in all of Wolfgang's recent works. Social scientists typically strive to predict future scenarios. One of the problems with hypothetical ways of reasoning is that alternative economic systems are imagined in negative terms as what capitalism is not. In the 1920s and 30s, a number of distinguished scholars were involved in a debate on the feasibility of socialism, known as the socialist calculation debate. It was ignited by an article that Ludwig von Mises wrote in the aftermath of the Soviet Revolution, arguing that rational allocation would be impossible in socialist economies, thus dooming them to failure. Mises' main opponent was the Polish economist Oskar Lange, whose name is associated with the so-called Lange-Lerner theory. This theorem posits that a common economy based on collective ownership of the means of production can achieve Pareto efficiency by simulating the market mechanism. How does this model work? The Central Planning Board sets the price of consumer goods and instructs state-owned firms to determine output targets so that the marginal cost is equal to price. This allows for minimization of the cost of production. Then the same board has to ensure equilibrium between supply and demand, which cannot be taken for granted in a system where prices are arbitrarily set. This is obtained through a trial and error adjustment process similar to Varras-Tatonement, whereby prices are lowered or increased to compensate for oversupply or undersupply of a given good. The board is also responsible for reinvesting profits in accordance with the planned growth rate and distributing social dividends. While most of these theoretical problems that were once associated with socialism have now lost importance, the vast majority of social scientists, including an increasing number of economists, accept that actual markets work in a more complex way than predicted by the general equilibrium model. Economic decisions are dependent on prices no more than on other types of signals, and prices themselves often result from circumstances that have little to do with the dynamic of perfect competition. Indeed, economic sociology has reached, has brought these insights to a high level, a very high level of intellectual sophistication, but every introductory microeconomics textbook nowadays includes a chapter on information asymmetries. Neither was Pareto efficiency a primary concern when socialism came to be actually applied in the 20th century in the Soviet Union or elsewhere. Central planning developed outside the neoclassical framework, and this can hardly be regarded as the main cause for the economic collapse of the Eastern Bloc. The excessive emphasis placed on the production of instrumental goods, especially in strategic sectors, at the expense of private consumption, and the rigidity of the industrial structure were certainly detrimental in the long run. But they should be put into perspective and interpreted as symptoms of a more general failure to accomplish political and social modernization. When one turns to the history of Russia over the past century, from post-feudalism to Stalinism to present-day neo-tsarism, the impression is that different oligarchies have followed one another, but very little has changed in terms of the relationship between power and society, in terms of how the relationship between power and society is conceived. Let's recapitulate again, for the sake of clarity, the issues at stake. I will take the Frankfurt point that capitalism needs welfare to survive, but not the ex post deduction that the latter, in its institutionalized form, represents a historical prerequisite for the development of the former. In other terms, this view of welfare is historically acceptable to the extent to which it is depurated of any functionalist implication. I also agree with those who think that capitalism is in a predicament, and will sooner or later come to an end, but I also think that it's not necessarily going to be replaced by its opposite, whatever form the opposite of capitalism might take in our imagination. On the contrary, I would like to argue that a radical U-turn is the least plausible scenario. Not because I believe in power dependence, which is typically an ex post construction, or I'm neglectful of the lesson of Alexander Gershenkron that continuity and discontinuity in history are more often than not in the eye of the beholder. I'm basing my opinion on the observation that revolutions are not the usual way of resolving the conflict between the mechanical foundations of a socio-economic system and needs originating from the cultural latency sphere. The expression cultural revolution, so frequent in common parlance, is, as I have said, an oxymoron, and revolutions leading to the subversion of a socio-economic order are as rare as delusional. Whether or not one subscribes to Barrington Moore's or Scott Paul's particular explanations, either they represent the ending point of a gradual process, a sort of political coup de grace, or their effect subsides in a span of time ranging from a few years to a few decades. They may have a destabilizing effect in the long run, especially when they follow a cumulative pattern. But this is unlikely to be the consequence of a single, albeit significant, event. Events like the taking of the Bastille don't transform structures, Pace, William Sewell, and the constructivists. On the other hand, the Marxist stage theory, according to which capitalism is the necessary outcome of feudalism, and precedes the advent of communism is flawed because it doesn't take cultural variables into account. It sees nothing but structure. How can societies that have been based for centuries on private property, I do not mean full property rights, which are recent, let's say, post-Napoleonic institution, but nonetheless rights over things, how can they turn to collectivism? How can they get rid of power relations that have been around since antiquity and reproduced in ever-changing form men's domination over men? The Soviet Revolution of 1917 doesn't prove Marx right, as in spite of the Bolshevik rhetoric of fighting the kulaks, bloodsuckers and enemies of the proletariat, it actually marked the transition from one collectivist social arrangement, post-feudalism, to another. The future of European economies and societies is unlikely to be one of pure capitalism or socialism. The question is rather how much individualism and how much collectivism the mix will contain. To give you a clearer idea of what I mean, I have drawn up a 2x2 table. The main socioeconomic systems that in this part of the world have followed one another over the past 2,000 years or so can be schematically described by combining two variables. One is ownership of the factors of production on the y-axis, on the y-axis, which has been concentrated in private or public hands to varying degrees. And the second variable on the x-axis is market pervasiveness vis-à-vis other transactional modes, transactional modes in Polanyi's sense, indeed. When pervasiveness is high, it can be termed commodification. When it's low, resource allocation is entrusted instead to reciprocity, redistribution, or central planning. Indeed, such variables are by no means exclusive. You may want to add more variables and ingredients. My very limited artistic artistic skills have prevented me from doing so. So each of the four quadrants corresponds to an ideal type which doesn't necessarily have a counterpart in the Western historical experience. Therefore, we find going clockwise the ancient economy based on slavery and the pursuit of self-sufficiency, and the other pre-capitalist systems, Atlantic capitalism and its neoliberal offspring, the socialist market economy or state capitalism of today's China, and Soviet-style socialism. Well, the main difference between the latter two typologies lies in the fact that while in both systems private property of land is either absent or restricted, Chinese state-owned enterprise don't operate in the context of central planning, but rather in a regime of market resource allocation. In this model, as you see, democratic capitalism or European-style social democracy is situated right at the center of the table. It's like an equilibrium vector resulting from the precarious compromise between social forces pushing in opposite directions. The directions which are historically determined come from quadrants 2 and 4. Around this point, is an area delimited by a circle, including less extreme and more hybrid versions of the ideal types. Among these, we may find actual historical experience, such as the National Socialist Economy or the Mitterrand experiment of the early 80s, as well as an array of theoretical possibilities. Well, when it comes to the evolution of post-democratic capitalism, what can, in my view, be realistically expected to happen in the next few decades corresponds to the area within the circle. Rising instability goes hand in hand with divergence from the post-war equilibrium, and the pendulum is likely to swing back and forth from the market to state. However, the state is considerably weaker today than it was 3 decades ago, for neoliberalism has eroded the foundations of sovereignty. The 21st century will probably witness a countless sequence of social reactions and counter-reactions, just like the 20th century experienced the great transformations described in Mark Blythe's book. But such reactions are likely to be much more chaotic and disorganized. Moreover, the neoliberal infiltration of the European left has created much confusion in the electorate. As you know, I'm not a political scientist, just a reader of newspapers. On 9th January, Le Monde published a rather long enquete puzzling over the ideas of François Hollande, socialist ou libéral. And the so-called Italian left is now led by a young man, one with an unsettling resemblance to Wilde's Dorian Gray, who is much excited about what he believes to be his major political innovation, the third way. As a result, participation is going to become the next prime minister at the end of this week, probably. As a result, participation is declining everywhere, and social protest is what emerges from the polls. According to a recent poll, the Front National is the most popular party in France, supported by about 1 in 4 voters. The Dutch populist party PVV is expected to secure up to 25% of the vote in the May European Parliament election. Italy's Green Fascists, as Der Spiegel calls them, got 25% of the vote, 25%. At the political election last year, however, austerity discontents also engrossed Berlusconi's party with its strong populist drive. In peaceful Austria, 30% of the voters chose either xenophobic FPO or other Eurosceptic parties. And what of Golden Dome political future? The disorganized nature of the protest and the lack of a realistic political agenda on the part of its leaders is not something reassuring. This is how, in 1930, the Spanish philosopher José Ortega y Gasset described la rebelión de las masas, or the revolt of the masses. I quote, "There appears for the first time in Europe a type of man who does not want to give reasons or to be right, but simply shows himself resolved to impose his opinions. The average man finds himself with ideas in his head, but he lacks the faculty of ideation. He has no conception, even of the rare atmosphere in which ideals live. He wishes to have opinions, but is unwilling to accept the conditions and presuppositions that underlie all opinion. Hence, his ideas are in effect nothing more than appetites in words." this man is still with us. His ideas may not be high ideals, but neither mere appetites, as Ortega rather cynically dismissed them. They reveal social needs that have long been repressed. The culture industry may have shaped his tastes, but hasn't changed his fundamental aspiration to live a decent life. He's neither good nor bad, but we've been taught that evil is banned. Overall, if I were a political scientist, I think I would be more worried about the future of democracy than that of the welfare state. Thank you.